be able to study the shockwave like that.
Interesting. Let's see what Don's got to say about this one. WA2ZOZ, K2RIW. Go ahead, Don.
Thank you. Let me drop it. Okay. There is a light phenomenon. Obliteration. Solar obliteration. I saw a program, I believe it was on the Discovery Channel or the Sci-Fi Channel. It is, I wouldn't say it's a trick of light, but there are circumstances with the sun and solid objects on Earth which cause something similar. And if you gentlemen would look up solar obliteration, that question or part of the question. Go ahead.
So if I understand you correctly, Don, if I do a Google on atomic test plus solar obliteration, or maybe a search in the YouTube videos, well, it looks like I'm going to have to go over to the other antenna. Stand by. Yeah, with my stronger antenna, I can overload this guy. So if I do a search on solar obliteration plus atomic test and do it by either a Google search or do it by YouTube video, I think you're saying I will find some further information on this. Is that true, Don? WA2ZOZ, K2RIW.
What I would try, first I would try solar obliteration. Then, I don't know if it would take me any farther, it probably would, but then I would try solar obliteration atomic testing. However, first I would try solar obliteration to get the phenomenon is.
Okay, I thank you for that information, Don and Dave. Looks like we'll eventually get to the bottom of this. That's a new one on me. And so, you have to look at the trail of the nice thing about the rocket is it's giving you a nice straight trail at lots of altitudes. So therefore, you can look at the individual layers of the wind and find out which way it's going. Therefore, you know where the fallout's going to go. As you know, some of the Pacific tests at times turned up some very unpleasant incidences because the wind aloft was blowing in some other direction than anticipated. And people, quite a few miles downrange in some other direction, had fallout fall on them. They thought it was snow, and it created quite a bit of damage. So nuclear testing is really something. Back to you, John, if you got any others. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Yes, Dick, I know it's getting late, so we'll do one more. I have a question on the green wire antenna. Let me let it drop. All right, KC2WGB. I have a gentleman who wants to put up a 20 and 40 meter vertical antenna in the pine tree, very similar to what Mel had. He wants to know, first of all, he's going to have two wires running up the tree, one for 20, one for 40. Does he have to keep them separate? And can he just staple them to the tree, or should he mount them off on standoffs or put them in a PVC pipe? What type of installation should he use? He heard our conversation about a year ago. In fact, it was more than a year ago when Mel had done that at his yard, and he seemed to have good luck with that. So maybe you can give him a couple of tips on that. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Yeah, Mel's green wire antenna was not stapled to his evergreen tree that was out in front of his house in Brooklyn, Manhattan Beach, Brooklyn. I think he had an egg insulator on the upper end. Some form of rope went from that egg insulator to one of the convenient branches of the tree to
wire, and the diameter of the wire is not very critical. You're selecting the diameter of the wire just for physical strength reasons, and whether or not it's got a green covering. I guess it would help if the wire is insulated. It gives you a little bit of insulation because if you're running pretty high power, the voltages at the tip of the antenna might be arcing over to the tree. And if it was a super dry tree, I've noticed some of the evergreen trees on the south shore of Long Island where Sandy did quite a bit of damage. For some reason, some of the evergreen trees have suddenly turned brown and they're not evergreen anymore. And they look to me like one hell of a fire hazard. So I'd worry about that a little bit. I would not staple the wire to the tree because in direct contact with a tree, let me drop. In direct contact with the tree itself, depending on what kind of a tree it is, had various amounts of sap flowing in the tree at different times of the year. So the dielectric constant of the tree is changing considerably. That'll change the tuning of your antenna. I don't think you need more than a few inches of spacing between the vertical wire and the trunk of the tree, but I would space it from the trunk of the tree. The wire itself, the half-wavelength piece of wire, I don't think you have to separate the two antennas side by side by not very many inches. You don't want them wrapped around each other, but a few inches of spacing will do. If you take a look at the way people build a fan dipole, the 40-meter, the 20-meter, the 10-meter dipole, they all come together at one point in the center. That's zero spacing there. And you do have some significant spacing at the end, separate insulators. And so of a similar construction, I would do that between the two separate antennas. Now, the antenna itself, being vertically polarized and a half wavelength long, you're going to get performance out of that like you wouldn't believe. Let me drop. And you've got the choice. You can decide to feed it in the center in the typical manner, bring the feed line off at a right angle over to the trunk of the tree, and the feed line is allowed to lie against the trunk of the tree. However, if you're a little bit smarter, as Mel was, and you feed it from the bottom, now there's a solid piece of wire that's a half wavelength long. There is no center insulator, and you feed it from the bottom at the ground level. You need no real counterpoise. A simple little stake in the ground would be more than enough grounding. That's the good news. The bad news of feeding it from the bottom, but another piece of good news is it's very mechanically convenient and very high in efficiency. The slight piece of bad news is that you're feeding an antenna on the outer edge, and you're going to be feeding not a 50-ohm or a 70-ohm antenna. You're going to be feeding something closer to 2,000 ohms. There's nothing magic about feeding a dipole in the center. You can feed the dipole in the center, 10% off to one side, 30%, 50%, 100% off to one side. You end up with different impedances, and you have a different requirement for a balancing structure when you do that. But the dipole itself, all you're doing is you're launching energy into the dipole. Wherever the gap is that you're doing the launch, that's where you're mounting a pump, so to speak, and you're pumping some charge from one side of the dipole to the other side on the first half cycle, and the other half cycle you're pumping it in the other direction. And when you're at the outer edge of the dipole, you could say you're pumping charge from Mother Earth into the dipole, but you're doing it with a 2,000 ohm impedance. Very little ground plane radials are required at that point. Simple grounding structure would be more than enough. But the fact that it's vertically polarized, you'd be amazed what efficiency you're going to get. I'm amazed that vertically polarized half-wave antennas are so non-popular. And I think it's simply because everybody goes to the same instruction manual when you're studying for your ham radio license, and they show you a dipole as a center-fed, thoroughly horizontal object that's completely parallel to the Earth. Everybody burns that into their mind. They think that's the only way to build a dipole. They don't realize that the dipole itself can be zigzagged in all kinds of ways, loading coils, top hat capacitors, helical wound, all kinds of things. One of the things that I did this week that was a mind-blower to me is various guys have signed in from time to time talking about the hex beam antenna. And they're starting to say very positive words about it. I Googled the word hex beam and started reading. Wow. Is that an antenna? Extremely high performance, two-element, Yagi-like antenna. There, the driven element is literally bent zigzag back and forth into a very significant W shape with a 60-degree angle on those Ws, on those bends. And yet, that that driven element of the hex beam dipole with the parasitic element right alongside of it has a, at points, there are certain points in that antenna where the director, where the reflector and driven element are a very small number of inches away from each other. They come to each other very close at points. However, let me drop. No matter how you build a dipole or the parasitic element for the reflector, no matter how you zigzag it, up and down, left and right, helical wound, loading coils, top hat capacitors, every final dipole has a phase center to it. If you stand far enough away, make the right kind of measurement on the right kind of an antenna range, it will appear to you during your measurements like all the energy is coming from one single point in space. It's called the phase center. So as far as that hex beam is concerned, somewhere in the vicinity of that driven element is its phase center. Somewhere in the vicinity of that W-shaped, upside-down W reflector assembly of the hex beam is the phase center of the reflector. Those two phase centers are separated by the right number of wavelengths. They've got the right number of electrical lengths of reflector and driven elements, so that it gives you an extremely low VISWA, reasonably wide bandwidth, significant amount of forward gain. There are reports of at least 4.5 and as high as 6 decibels of forward gain and 15 to 20 decibels of front-to-back ratio on a very light, low wind resistance, very small turning radius antenna. That's a lot of antenna. Very crafty. So all those guys who have been talking about the hex beam, and I didn't know what the heck it was, I've suddenly found out what it was. Some significant people, I can't think of the name of the guy now from CQ Magazine, who did a report on it, and boy, he normally is a very conservative guy, and he said some very positive things about that antenna. So, this vertical dipole, I recommend you feed it at the bottom. You build yourself a very simple LC network, a so-called L-pad, an L impedance matcher, which steps your 50 ohms up to the 2,000.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
A very simple L network that steps your 50 ohms of your transmitter and feed line up to 2,000 ohms, maybe it's 1,800, but it's in that vicinity, which is the outer impedance of the antenna, and I think you're going to be very pleased. And so from that bottom point, if you feed it, I'll admit that you're not using the full altitude of the tree on the 80 meter versus the 40 meter, so to speak. And I guess there are ways that you could find, build an elevated feed for the 40 meter antenna. I would be tempted to just feed both of them from the bottom. So I would space it from the tree for reasons of fire protection and lack of change in tuning as the tree goes between its seasons. And I would feed it from the bottom, but if you're more comfortable feeding it from the center in the more conventional manner, go for it. And after he builds this antenna, suggest that the guy come back to us and tell us how great it is, because I think he's going to be very pleasantly surprised. That was Jay. Of all the years of experience that Mel had on building antennas, that green wire antenna was near the top of the list of the things that he did that was very simple and a lot of fun. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Yeah, I know Mel had a lot of great contacts with that antenna. He raved about it, so I'm sure he's going to be very happy with it. Well, that's about it from the mailbag, Dick. So we'll pick it up again next week. Get over to Paul. It's getting late. KC2WGB.
And so we know, Dick.
You got a comment, Rich? Go right ahead.
I'd like to revisit that fellow who complained about the static on the antenna. Rather, you know, when he was with the radios in the car. I may have an answer. I couldn't come back before because I was in a lot of pain and Patricia was helping me.
Go right ahead with your suggestions, Rich. How would you solve that rolling automobile where the noise is only there when the car is in motion? N2EO, wait for the four beeps, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, that's the key. It's not the engine running, it's when the car is in motion. I remember years and years ago, I don't know why I remember this stuff, there was something in the ARRL handbook. It was either in the late 50s or early. Of anti-static powder to the inside of the tire just to alleviate that problem. Now, I don't know if these were the days of tube tires. It was, if it was talcum powder, but that's all I know. Back to net and to the
W2NDG.
Neil recognized it. You in a second, Neil. Yeah, I guess certain brands of tires. In fact, maybe that's the clue. In the old days, tires were made out of pure rubber, and therefore they need this anti-static device on the greased bearing on the two front wheels. And I'm guessing they now put conductive materials inside of the tires to discharge the static electricity. But maybe certain brands of tires are not being built in that manner, and so putting anti-static powder in the tire maybe is the right answer. Yes, in the old days you could buy that substance. Do you think it's still available today, Rich? Where would I go to buy anti-static powder for the inside of my tire? If you happen to know, N2EO, KQLIW.
I wouldn't have the slightest idea, Dick, but I put it in the tire. Wait a minute.
Sounds like Rich might not know where you can buy this stuff, but at least we know that such a stuff exists. Neil, have you ever heard of anti-static powder? And where would a guy in New York City buy that? W2NDG, K2LIW.
Just that it was static, and there was a website where some truckers were discussing the same issue, and they were talking about graphite powder, which I know is sometimes used as a dry lubricant. I've seen it in hardware stores, so that's what they were saying, graphite powder.
Okay, that's a darn good suggestion. Let me get a beep. Okay, so the graphite powder, yes, that really is carbon granules of a kind, or it's actually tiny little sheets of, what is it called now? Nanotubes. So graphite powder might be what you add to the tire in order to get rid of the static. It's worth a try. That would be the solution if, after following John's suggestion, you roll down the hill with the engine turned off and you still hear the static. Then you know quite possibly it is something to do with the rolling operation. Static electricity being picked up by the tires and being periodically discharged, and/or sheet metal rattling. Okay, back to you, John, if you got any others. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
KC2WGB. Well, you could always go back to the old trailing strap. Remember those on the old fuel trucks? But no, it's late. I think we should go to Paul. I got a couple left, but we'll save those for next week. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Very fine, John. Paul, WS2N, you might have to use the Eastern input tonight. That's my guess, but give it a try. WS2N, K2LIW.
WS2N, Dick. All right, if you want me to switch over, I'll do that.
Give it a brief try, and you might have to switch over. Try it right now and see if we can get through.
Okay, very good. WS-20 to the space port. portion of the TechNet. I didn't have that much anyway, but a couple of things I wanted to go over. One thing in particular was the spacecraft that was launched 10 years ago, and it's about a year away from going to its target to drop it.
I was hearing you quite well, Paul. Why don't you continue for a little while?
Okay. I don't.
Okay, I think you're on the eastern input and it sounds better. Please proceed.
Okay, well, leave well enough alone. Rosetta spacecraft I've been about because this thing's only about a year from getting to its target. It's planning to rendezvous with a comet, but it was launched a long time ago. So it was launched in 2004, and it wasn't launched from Florida. It was launched from South America, from French Guiana, and it's been in this process of getting to this comet all this time. It's passed the Earth three times, Mars two times. It's using the planet as a gravitational assist to get out there. It's got big solar panels on it. It's primarily a European Space Agency mission, but there are NASA components involved, and some of the instruments are from JPL. So it's really an international effort. A lot of other countries are also involved in the land. They do have a lander on this thing. Let me drop. It's going to rendezvous with this comet. And when it gets nearby, the land is going to set down. It's got three long legs on it. And it's got they're going to launch a couple of little rockets into the ground of the rocket to hold it there. It's very, very little gravity, and they don't want it to float away. So then that thing will send information up to what would be now the mothership, the Rosetta. And that in turn will send the information back to the Earth. And it's going to ride along with the comet all the way to the perihelion. And so you're going to look at maybe a year and a half of this mission, of doing this on board land. They had a similar machine that they have on Curiosity, and they've got a heater on board and some kind of a spectrometer thing where they're going to be able to into the surface of the comet and dig up some of the ice, drop it. Of course, turn it. See what it comes out. Compare it to the common water that we have here on Earth. And that's going to tell them a lot about maybe how a lot of the water got here at the beginning was mainly from comets. Don't forget, this thing is, it's really like going back in time. It's from, you know, 4.5 billion years ago. It existed all that time, undisturbed. So it's really going back to the formation of the solar system and what it was like back then. So I thought I'd bring up Rosetta and two other little articles that I wanted to bring up. One is, we've talked about quite a bit, is the TDRS. Launched the tracking data relay satellite. It was originally scheduled for the 29th, and actually it was supposed to go up at the end of the year, but it was delayed, and it was going to go up the 29th. Now it's going to go up the 30th at 8:30, I think it was 8:52 p.m., and that's Wednesday night. And that will be launched from Cape Canaveral. You have
Atlas V attached to it, and that's the one that's going to go into geosynchronous orbit. And I'm not going to go on about that because we covered that pretty much last week, but I just want to mention that the launch announced one day later, for Wednesday. So I'd like to see that get up there. It's a new type of tracking data relay satellite. It's the third generation, and they have two more that will eventually go up, one I think at the end of the year, and maybe another one next year, or the beginning of 2015. I'll drop it. And like I said, I didn't have that, but I just mentioned that this is the 46th anniversary today of the Apollo 1 fire. So it's hard to believe that many years have gone by, but I remember that quite well when that happened, when we lost the three astronauts on the pad. Fire started inside the spacecraft during a test, and we lost Grissom, White, and Chaffee. That's Grissom had flown on previous missions on Mercury and then on Gemini. And Ed White was the first American to do a spacewalk on Gemini. He was up McDiffin and White on Apollo 3. So, on Gemini. Gemini 3. Correction, Gemini 4. That would be 4. That would be Gemini 4. So, 46 years. Back to you, Dick. WSON, not much for tonight, but we'll be here for any questions.
Very fine, Paul. When I looked at the TDRS website last night, and they still were saying January 29, and you've since found out it's going to be moved off until January 30. I think it says it's going to be launched from launch pad 42, and they had just done a replacement of the booster ordnance assembly or something like that. The word ordnance led me to believe that there's some kind of a circuit on board, which I guess in a worst-case situation uses an ordnance in order to take a misfired launch and scatter the materials. Am I misinterpreting that? This launch circuit, this ordnance launch, there's a three-letter abbreviation which I've forgotten. I wonder if you've heard about that one, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
I don't recall.
That was cause for the delay. I wanted to check something out.
I don't think it was a pyrotechnic device. I'm not sure what that was.
Every one of these missions, even the last one I mentioned, Rosetta, 10 years ago, was delayed because of weather, you know, high winds, and then it was delayed because of the cryogenic covering on it. And come off, and they had to bring the whole thing back to the off the launch pad, and then they bring it back. So it's a common occurrence. Apparently whatever they were looking at, they must have gotten straightened out. Don't recall the exactly what it was, but the teacher suspected it.
Okay, I thank you, Paul. What I did this week that I was going to mention to you guys is I did two experiments. One is I have put some more chocolate bars in my microwave oven. And second of all, I did finally carry out the experiment with salt water conductivity to a human being. And I saw evidence that lead me to believe that this hypothesis of mine that an awful lot of those people who appeared to drown during Hurricane Sandy, I think they were really electrocuted. And I'll give you a couple examples of what I'm talking about. If I took something like a 1 kilo resistor and put it on the table,
and you connect your two leads of your ohm meter to it, yes, you'll measure 1,000 ohms. And whether you connect to the leads coming out of the resistor real up close or real far away from the resistor, as long as you're making contact to the wires, you'll end up with very close to 1,000 ohms every time you make the measurement. If you put your two ohm meter leads on the wire coming out of the resistor on one side, you'll measure something very close to 0 ohms. So in the case of a typical RCO7 type carbon resistor, for instance, the 1,000 ohms is really a lump of material in the middle of that package. Okay, that's a, let me call that a point source resistor. It's a nearly point source. If I took a sheet of conducting material, like slightly conducting rubber, I take 1 square foot of this stuff, and I put an ohm meter at each corner of the conductive sheet, I'll measure some relatively high number of ohms. But if I was really doing a resistivity measurement of this conductive sheet, assuming it's got uniform conductivity across it, what you would do is you would take a square of the material, you'd put a metallic contacting surface along the total left-hand edge. It would be 1 foot long contacting device. You'd put 1 foot long contacting device on the right-hand side, metallic, and you'd measure the number of ohms between the two. And if you did that experiment with the exact same kind of material, but if you did it with the material 1 square foot, 1 square inch, 1 square centimeter, 1 square yard, you'd end up with the exact same number of ohms in that test.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You'd end up with the exact same number of ohms in that test. Therefore, when it comes to a sheet of material, the units that you use to measure its resistivity is called ohms per square. And of course, a person learning electronics for the first time will say, ohms per square what? Is it square inch, square centimeter, square foot, square yard, square meter, square mile? The answer is yes to all of the above. Once you've got the exact same kind of material and it's in a perfect square, and the two opposite edges have been made metallically conductive, and you put your ohm meter between those two edges, you'll measure the exact same number of ohms. Whereas if you decrease the length of the metallic structure on the left side versus the right side, you start measuring a higher number of ohms. When you start plotting what are the constant voltage lines, so to speak, across the material created by your ohm meter, the field intensity lines, I guess you could call it, why it behaves that way becomes a little bit more understandable. The next step is to measure a volumetric material, like seawater. And seawater, I believe now it has to be an exact dimension. In other words, seawater is measured in ohm meter. If I took 1 cubic meter of seawater, I've got a plastic fish tank that's exactly 1 meter in all three dimensions, and I fill it up with seawater. The far left-hand side of the fish tank, I make a 1 square meter sheet metal against the left-hand side, and another 1 square meter sheet of metal on the right-hand side, and I put an ohm meter between the two. You can look this up as to the resistivity of seawater, and you'll find out the answer is 0.2 ohm meter. So if I took ordinary seawater in that fish tank between those two metal plates, I would measure.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Between those two metal plates, I'd measure 0.2 ohms. That surprised the daylights out of me. I expected the answer to be something like a 10 or 50 or 100 ohms, 0.2 ohms. Seawater is extremely conductive. Okay, that's volumetric. A human being, in my opinion, is quasi-volumetric. You take the two leads coming out of your volt ohm milliammeter or your ohm meter, and you touch them, your index finger and thumb on the right-hand side, index finger and thumb on the left-hand side, on the 2 meters, on the two leads, and you might measure something like 30,000, 50,000, 100,000 ohms, depending on how wet your fingers are, how hard you squeeze. Put two great big clip leads on the two ohm meter leads and duplicate it, and you'll measure half the number of ohms. You'll suddenly realize it's an area relationship. Okay. What I finally did was to take my two metal bowls, which even though in the beginning I made one bowl out of aluminum and one bowl out of stainless steel, and I suddenly realized it really was a 0.6-volt battery, and with salt water in there, and therefore it was driving my ohmmeter crazy, and it was very polarity sensitive. I finally took my two stainless steel bowls and lined each one of them. Let me drop. I lined each one of them with aluminum foil and then filled them up with water that I had poured a significant amount of table salt into. And I also poured the water back and forth between another container just to make sure that the salinity of both sides was the same. And I again checked voltage when I put my hands in it, and I was reading some very small number of volts. So I know that it wasn't a battery. And the bottom line was, with my left hand under the salty water, my right hand under the salty water, and these two aluminum-lined stainless steel bowls and an ohmmeter between each one, I measured 1.5 kiloohms. From my left hand to my right hand, 1.5 kiloohms. And as I pressed my hand down onto the bottom of the metal, as opposed to just floating in the salt water, nothing changed. In other words, obviously the salt water was the major conductivity, and it was hitting the top of my hand, the bottom of my hand, each of my fingers. What's really going on here is that as you expose more and more skin, that in turn is, by way of the salt water, the seawater, creating more and more conductivity through your epidermis, your dermis, and your lower materials into the bloodstream. The total amount of area of your body in contact with the seawater makes a huge difference on the number of ohms you measure. I could tell by sinking a finger into the salt water, two fingers and so on, I would watch the ohmmeter go down as I exposed more and more area of my skin to the salt water. Therefore, I know darn well that if I had enough, large enough volume tank to do it with, and I sunk my whole right arm and hand into salt water, and my whole left arm and hand in salt water, I would measure an even lower number of ohms than 1.5 kiloohms. I'll bet you, between the left arm and my right arm, I'm going to make a speculation that I could probably get that down to a couple of hundred ohms.
Repeater, time. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Because we know that at 60 cycles, approximately 60 milliamps flowing from left hand to right hand, there's a high probability it will give you electrocution. It will send your heart into fibrillation. You go through the mathematics of that, and you'll soon realize that very little voltage drop across the seawater with you in it, depending on how you are oriented. If the lines of constant voltage in that seawater are parallel to your left and right hand or left and right foot, arm, and or leg that's in that seawater, maybe you're okay. You rotate your body 90 degrees and you're going to be electrocuted. You don't want your body in seawater. If anywhere within sight of that seawater, it is about to come in contact with an electrical outlet, a fuse box, or anything else that's got electricity. You don't want your body in seawater with electricity. And there have been stories of people who are in seawater swimming when lightning struck the seawater not too far away, and they suffered some serious damage. So because that seawater from Hurricane Sandy was washing into people's homes, let me drop. It was washing into people's homes. And in some cases, they suddenly realized, gee, my basement is filling up with seawater, and I've got this and that valuable object down there. I'm going to go down and rescue it. I think that's the method by which some of those people died from electrocution. They went into the seawater in the basement, not realizing that as it rises, it's eventually going to touch some electrical outlet that is still live. It is my guess that the Long Island Lighting Power Company and Con Edison and whatever, whenever they know that seawater was washing into a particular community, in many cases they pulled the plug on that community because they have knowledge of this problem. It's not very well advertised. So be careful. And these early measurements I've made are scaring the daylights out of me as to how dangerous seawater is when any electrical contact is being made to that seawater. Anybody have any further questions or comments on this, give me your call letters at this time, K2RIW.
WGB would comment.
Go right ahead, John.
So from those measurements, you realize that I guess you would be near 80 milliamps, correct?
What I'm saying is that I can hit 80 milliamps, 60 milliamps, I think is the number. Whether it's 60 or 80, I'm not sure now. But 80 milliamps I can hit with a very small number of volts in that seawater if a large amount of the area of my body is in contact with that seawater. What my experiment is telling me is that as more and more of your body is in that seawater, the amount of conductivity between your skin and that blood supply, and that blood supply is a rather highly saline solution, your blood is an extremely conductive material, probably not too different than seawater. So as you make more and more contact with greater and greater area to those veins and arteries in your arms and legs, and they in turn are like electrical wires, so to speak, that go through your heart and lungs and brain, all of which cannot tolerate very much voltage. Are you being electrocuted because of the blood flow is being electrified and it goes up the two carotid arteries on the left and right side of your head? Is it the brain that's being electrocuted? Is it the heart or the lungs? Does it matter? You don't want to be in seawater with electricity. And so because I could come up with, I could speculate that between my left arm and my right arm, I might hit a number like 100 ohms. And how many volts does it take to get 60 milliamps on 100 ohms? I think the answer is 6 volts. If 6 volts is flowing through, if there's a 6 volt drop between the portion of the water that's near my left arm and the portion of the water between my right arm, then because of the resistivity of my body in that environment being as low as 100 ohms, with 6 volts in the voltage drop across the seawater, I think you have just become electrocuted. KC2W.
Repeater, time out. Cancel.
KC2WGB, K2IW, go ahead, John.
Well, Dick, with both of your hands in there, I doubt if you had, maybe you had a square foot total. So, yeah, 6 ohms, I'm sure you could get to that value very quickly when you had half of your body submerged in the water, without a doubt.
Victor Echo 3, Juliet, India, Whiskey, the E3JIW.
Go right ahead, Jim. The E3JIW, K2RIW.
If you had a meter of metal in a tank, you would have 2 meters of surface area if the water got behind the metal. I don't have Google from my mobile, but are you sure it's not microamps for electrocution? I saw a chart, I thought it's microamps to kill. Third thing, I was under a building lying on semi-dry sand. I grabbed a hold of the BX and felt electricity through a cut. I'd had my main breaker off, I grabbed the analog meter and I stuck a probe in the ground and I measured the shield of the BX or armored cable and saw about 5 volts AC. I don't know, you see the contact point of the meter was only the meter probe in the ground, whereas I had my back on the ground. I was getting voltage coming back on the ground from neighbors. So I think we've got a ground put in, but I think you might have had 2 meters of contact material if you had a meter of seawater. And I can't Google right now, but I really thought it was microamps to kill. Back to K2RIW in the group, the E3JIW.
KD2AOC with comment.
AOC recognized. Get to you in a second. Many of the sources you can read will tell you that from left hand to right hand, the threshold of current flow where you can start feeling the tingle is around 1 milliamp. If you Google electrocution and Wikipedia, they claim that at 60 cycles, I believe the number was 60 milliamps is current flow capable of being lethal, 60 milliamps. If I'm being catheterized with a saline solution, and now the electrical contact is taking place within the arteries and veins of the heart, right at the heart, yes, microamps. So depending where the current is entering, if it's really in the vicinity of the heart itself, microamps can do it. But from the outside,
the usual explanation is 60 milliamps. But I guarantee that's a, and by the way, there's a different number for AC current versus DC current. I think the number was 200 or 100 milliamps for DC current, but 60 milliamps on AC. And then part of the reason is that the intermittent nature of 60 cycle AC and the timing of the heart is such that there's a very critical time during the RST wave of the heart where there's one little critical time where a pulse of current at that instant can make the nodes of the heart start creating more than one pulse running around that circuit. And pretty soon the heart is in a very rapid fibrillation mode of operation where it no longer is pumping efficiently. And it's almost the equivalent of complete heart stoppage. Let me drop. So how much current? I think the answer was 60 milliamps is what I discovered from the outside of the body. But yes, it's microamps on the inside. Mr. AOC, go right ahead. K2RIW and the tech man.
Yes, hi, Dick. I read a story where an engineer, a young engineer, who was studying and did a lab experiment, went home and took a 9-volt battery, inserted two prongs into his, and it killed him. What my point is, and that was DC, what my point is, doesn't it make a difference how long somebody's in the water? Because once the water goes from the topical to the subcutaneous, it takes much less to affect the heart. Over.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's kind of obvious that when you stay in the tub too long, your skin starts becoming curdled. Obviously, the amount of moisture in that tub starts soaking through your cutaneous, subcutaneous, and so on. That water is soaking into your body, and I'm guessing is what you're saying is that most likely the conductivity is being lowered even further. The resistivity is being lowered. The conductivity is being increased. Therefore, the amount of voltage required for electrocution is going down. So, you got to be awful careful with high conductive surfaces. If a lot of area, by the way, I also, before putting the salt water into these containers, I turned them upside down, these stainless steel bowls, and with the ohmmeter between the two stainless steel bowls, just simply put my hand with lots of area of my hand directly onto the stainless steel, left hand and right hand. I vaguely remember the answer there was something like 15 kilo-ohms. If I could get down to 1.5 kilo-ohms with just left hand and right hand in salt water, I guess you could say each hand to the salt water was half of the 1.5 kilo-ohms, 750 ohms. And I'm reasonably sure that if I left my hand in there for a longer period of time and soaked up the water, if a greater amount of area of my hand, forearm, and so on, the rest of my arm was in the salt water, I know the number would continuously go down because it's a volumetric circuit between the surface area of my skin. Let me drop. The surface area of my skin and how many parallel paths are they getting into the blood supply. I am guessing the current flow through the blood supply is the major mechanism by which external to the body electrocution takes place. You would think by common sense that, hey, it's going to be flowing through the nerves because we all picture our nerves like wires. Well, you find out that the real signal flowing down your nerves is a periodic chemical signal between the individual nerve cells. There is a chemical transfer that takes place. Are the nerves more conductive than the blood supply? I think the answer is no, because the nerves are so small in diameter, whereas the blood supply is a significant amount of very conductive fluid. The plasma of your blood is very conductive. In fact, someday I've got to do an experiment. If I can draw enough of my blood and actually find out what is the volume resistivity of my blood, well, I'm sure there must be a Wikipedia site that's got that. I don't have to sacrifice my blood to do that. Mr. AOC, go right ahead with any further comments. K2RIW.
Also, Dick, wouldn't it also make sense that If you walked into a basement that was full of water, that you probably would either hold on to a waste line pipe or to your heating pipe, and aren't those grounds for many aspects of the home? So couldn't you have completed the circuit once you touched one of the pipes? Over.
Oh, you're right on that one. If you're in that water and you're trying to navigate as it's coming up to your waist and maybe even higher, and therefore walking on the basement floor is very slow, and so if the ceiling and the joists and whatever are within reasonable range of you and you start walking across those and you touch a water pipe, if the water pipes in your house are copper, they are extremely well grounded by way of the main line coming into the house. On older houses, I guess some of the newer houses have got plastic pipes, but the older houses with copper pipe, they are extremely good ground. The BX cabling is an extremely good ground. There's a hell of a lot of things that you can touch that are grounded. And that seawater that you're wading through, if it's touching an electrical outlet, voltage-wise, it's hot. You're in it. You're very well conducting to that seawater. And now your hand touching something grounded could, without a doubt, complete the circuit. So I'm a little bit worried now that somebody's going to listen to what you and I are saying and saying, well, as long as I don't touch anything, I'm all right. Uh-oh. The seawater itself is going to have a voltage differential. There's going to be some number of volts per meter across the seawater, depending on how far away is it making contact to an electrical outlet, how far away is the nearest ground that the seawater is touching. It's touching pipes and whatever somewhere. In my case, the quickest thing that's going to be grounding the seawater is the oil pipe, the oil tank. My oil tank is down at the ground level of my basement. It's got a piece of copper tubing going over to the oil burner that brings the oil to it. The oil burner itself is grounded by way of the BX cable going to it. So in my case, at one end of the basement, my oil tank is creating a ground. The other end is going to be the fuse box or the electrical outlet for the dryer and the washing machine. And a
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
As the seawater comes up to those electrical contacts, or even maybe the power cord going to the washer or dryer, maybe it's not perfectly waterproof, watertight, and it's coming down to ground level from the from its outlet over to the actual machine, and water is touching it. There's a lot of ways that water is going to come in contact eventually with electrical outlets. So if the power is on in your house, well, even if the power is off, don't go into the seawater. If something goes wrong and the power gets turned on while you're in the basement, the bottom line is, if there's any water in your basement, or if you have any reason to believe that water is going to come into your basement, seawater, or even fresh water, don't go there. No matter what the hell is there, if it's a box full of money and there's thousands of dollars there, don't go there. That's my impression. Mr. AOC, for any other comments, KQRIW, please tell me your name. I should know it.
Yeah, sorry, Dick. My name is Dennis. Just one more thing. If you're going to do a study, and you've done your study on the salt water conductivity, would you not also want to find out how many of these people, the 100 people who were listed as drowning but were possibly electrocuted, were in basements that were non-GFI, because they would be older homes, and GFIs would probably trip, and you wouldn't actually be electrocuted unless it went up to the panel boxes? Over.
Yeah, but I, even if my boxes were GFI'd, I still wouldn't trust it. Because the GFI is removing the voltage from the portion of the plug, the female portion of the plug that you plug the wire into. The electrical power is still coming into the back of the GFI, and water is there. So I don't think you're going to get very much protection out of GFI. I wouldn't trust it. So if there's water in your basement, you don't want to go there. and I suddenly realized that I had a foot and a half of water in my basement due to a rainstorm before I established a good berm system in my house during a rainstorm and a snow melt. I remember a foot and a half of water in my basement, and I remember hooking up a pump to pump out the water. Wow. I don't know the safe way to remove the water from the basement. I was wearing hip boots at the time. I don't know if that would be enough protection. I remember feeling very uncomfortable while doing that. And one other time, I remember using a skill saw outside. I went to cut something, and it was a snowy day. And I'm holding on to this metal frame of a skill saw, an old-fashioned skill saw, while standing in wet snow. And it gave me a very uncomfortable feeling about if anything is wrong with the grounding of that system. I could be wiped out awful fast. Now back to you, Dennis. KQLIW.
Dick, I just want to say you're absolutely correct. The GFI is only what goes forward from that circuit onward, not what's behind it. So anything that's in the back of the box is going to charge the water that's there. So anybody going down into a basement where there's water, and there's GFI or a non-GFI, don't go there. Over.
Yeah, you wanted to know whether or not those houses were GFI equipped. And I think that's a little off to one side. I wish that of those people who were supposedly drowned, I wish that a significant number of them had had an autopsy. I'm assuming now that with a properly done autopsy, if you know what you're looking for, there's a way to find out, did the person die of electrocution or did he die of drowning? In either case, you got a problem, because even if you die of electrocution and you now sink into the water, your muscles are not working correctly, you're unconscious, but the automatic breathing system is such that some water is still going to get into the lungs. So a person who died during Hurricane Sandy, most likely you're going to find water in his lungs and you're going to jump to the conclusion that he was drowned. But was he electrocuted? Is there a way of differentiating electrocution versus drowning? I'd like to know, because what's sad in this situation is these people are dying because they're doing something logical and they weren't given the information. By the same token, with those heat waves that we've had 20 years ago in the Midwest, where 5,000 senior citizens died over about a one-month period spread over a couple of states. They died because of extra high temperature. You know, the outside temperature went to 105 degrees. These elderly people, let me drop it. These elderly people were worried about robbery or whatever, so they lock up the house, close the windows. The house goes to some ridiculous temperature. Pretty soon they're not feeling good. They lay down in their bed and die. Had they been given the right information, all they had to do is pour some water into the tub and sit in it. The way the water is such an extremely good cooling mechanism, the core temperature of their body wouldn't have gone above 106 degrees, and they wouldn't have died. That lack of a little piece of information could have saved a significant number of those 5,000 people. The media at that time didn't do their job of giving them the information that they needed. So a lot of people died, but because it spread all over the place, we never correlated, if you know what I mean. And here you had 100-some-odd people in the New York City area who died of what looks like drowning, but I think a high percentage of them are electrocution. You can see where I'm going on this one, Dennis. That's to AOC, K2LIW.
W, NJRW would like to say hi.
One thing I would say, I'm a member of CERT, which is Community Emergency Response Team, and one of the biggest jokes that are out there is, in case of an emergency like a hurricane, tornado, snow event, any natural disaster or man-made, that you should have 3 days' supply of food and water on it. No. You should have 2 weeks, because the cavalry may not get there in time. There's too few responders and too many people. So you really have to look at a longer picture and not just look for 3 days and say that it's all going to be over in a short time. I don't have